Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
We are born with 3,000 years of slavery and the victimhood and the atrocities, and we carry it on our backs since we are born, and we are being taught to feel that no one else is allowed to be a victim, only us. And we send our kids to Auschwitz when they are 16 years old, and they come back dragged with the national flag and the slogan "Never Again." And the next day, they are sitting in a checkpoint, and this 18 years old guy needs to make a decision whether this 70 years old guy coming towards him is a terrorist or a grandfather.
I'm Sarah Wilson, and this is Wild, a show where we talk with the biggest minds in the world about the ideas that can help us love and save our one wild and precious life together on this planet.
So there is quite a lot of background to this interview, and I invite all of you along for the journey. There's a backstory of how I came to meet my two guests today, the protagonists in the Booker long-listed book, A Paragon, that was written by Irish author Colin McCann. And I'll share that story in the next Wild episode. It's a truly strange and beautiful story in itself, involving sliding doors, a big-time Hollywood actor who reached out to me out of the blue while I was camping in remote Western Australia over Christmas, a second-hand book find, and a six-way email chain. Oh, and an incredible love that reaches across history, walls, and global fragmentation. And then there's also a bit of context to this interview that I'm about to have with my two guests that I do need to pass on. So in today's episode, I do in fact speak to two guests. They kind of come as a duo. They are two fathers living in the Middle East. Bassam Araman is a Palestinian who grew up in a cave near Hebron and who was imprisoned at the age of 17 for 7 years for attacking Israeli soldiers. About 40% of all Palestinian men are imprisoned in Israeli jails at some point in their lives, and in a great many cases without trial. Now, while he was in prison, where he was often in solitary confinement for singing and where he was a prisoner's leader, Bassam decided to learn about the Holocaust. Previously, he'd been told it never happened, that it was made up. But he watched a documentary while he was in solitary confinement, and he found it profoundly moving, so much so he went on to do a master's degree in the subject. Now, the other father, Rami Elenhan, is an Israeli Jew who served in the Israeli army, or the IDF, in several wars, but who opposes the occupation. Now, neither of these two men had ever met someone from the other side as a human, as opposed to being an enemy, until well into their adulthood. Actually, really, not until they were united by tragedy. In 1997, Rami lost his teenage daughter, Smadar, to a Palestinian suicide bomb attack in Jerusalem. He describes in this interview finding her in the morgue. A decade later, Bassam's daughter, Abir, was shot in the head by an Israeli soldier, totally unprovoked, as she walked into school. She was 10 years of age. The two men both decided to turn their grief into action, and have toured the world together with Parents Circle, a peace group set up for parents from, quote-unquote, both sides, who've lost a child. As I say, Irish writer Colin McCann was so moved by their story, he wrote a book about it, and it's called A Paragon. which means a shape of infinitely observable sides, a reference to the complexity of the religious, geopolitical, historical situation in this part of the world, and I suppose of the experience of being human. When we speak, it's day 169 into the conflict. There have been three false starts at trying to get all three of us on the line. On one attempt, it's Rami and I, the day before I leave Australia to come here to Paris. He and I are sitting there and I say, well, do you think Bassam's going to be able to join us? And Rami replies, well, it's Ramadan and, he's either sleeping from his hunger or he's dead, which was a joke, but also not really. But then I got a message, thankfully, the day I arrive in Paris, so about 3 days later, riddled with jet lag, from Bassam, calling from a checkpoint at Jericho, where he'd been stuck for 12 hours. As he explains, this is a normal part of life for Palestinians, to be held at one of the countless roadblocks and gates and walls by the Israeli army for often no reason. So Bassam arranges to head to a nearby room for the night, and he says to me, okay, dear, let us use this crisis for a good thing. So we message Rami, who has just landed back into Jerusalem. And as it turns out, these two men, they've just made a mad trip back from Italy where they'd met with the Pope, which we'll get to in a moment. Anyway, all of this is to explain that all of us are deliriously tired. I also have the flu, which you can probably hear. I'm also very emotional in this interview, and I speak slower and perhaps more mechanically than normal because the connection was super dodgy on top of all of this, and there was a language barrier, and it was a struggle to hear each other at times. And so the upshot is the quality of my brain is not great, nor is the recording. Thankfully, my wonderful sound producer, Steph, has done his best to smooth out the rough edges for us. Oh, and I should say Bassam's connection drops out completely at the end, and so he doesn't get to sign off. If you're interested, I have written a number of posts on my Substack over at sarahwilson.substack.com outlining various thoughts on how to navigate these infinite sides of this conflict, which I guess also represents just the one side of the crisis, which I feel represents or extends well beyond what is happening in Israel and Palestine. It implicates all of us in all kinds of mirror-refracting, doppelganger-projecting ways. Okay, that's probably enough by way of introduction for now. Bassam and Rami's story can speak for the rest. As I say, next episode, I will share another layer to this story. It's a layer that is really quite beautiful and that prompted Rami to say to me, "This proves there is in fact a God." Hello, Bassam, and hello, Rami. Thank you so much for making this work. It's not easy given the two of you are in the midst of a war zone and it's been quite difficult to get us all together, and I really, really appreciate it. Bassam, I know you've been trapped all day at a border crossing and that's been super tricky, and thank you so much for making time, as you say, bringing something or making something good out of this conflict. But you live in the West Bank, and I think people are very aware of what is happening in Gaza, obviously, the last 5 to 6 months. But what's it been like in the West Bank in that time?
Thank you very much for hosting us. The West Bank under siege, military siege, direct occupation. We cannot move out, we cannot move in. Like today, for example, they punish the whole West Bank. They are very professional in punishing or imposing collective punishment. They don't care about the kids on the borders, this weather, the women's. People come from all over the world, and people come from the West Bank to Jericho. They also stuck in Jericho, and it's Ramadan. They don't understand what's the meaning of Ramadan. In fact, they understand. This causes us more suffering. To regret that we born as a Palestinian. In fact, more than 500 Palestinians have been killed since the 7th of October, for example. More confiscated lands, the behavior of the settlers with the protection of the Israeli soldiers. They act like a mafia without no rules, without no consequences. Again, we cannot move anywhere, but in those days, in those months, the focus only on Gaza, to watch this genocide or mass killing. And it became normal for the world just to analyze the situation. And people are dying in basic minutes.
My understanding is that some of what's happening in the West Bank, particularly with the settlers, is happening because so much attention is on Gaza. And so there's not as much attention on what's happening in the West Bank. And so they're kind of pushing in and getting ground while everybody's distracted.
In fact, some Palestinians believe that what happened in Gaza, it's because of the Israeli settlers' behavior before the 7th of October. I believe it's true. It's not only because of that. In general, we said that the conflict didn't start on the 7th of October, which is true, and it didn't end with the 8th of October. So absolutely, they used the focus of the international attention on Gaza. And this is what they do in the West Bank.
Rami, you're in Jerusalem. What is the atmosphere like there? How are most Israelis viewing what's happening in Gaza? Almost 6 months into this conflict.
I think the most horrible thing that most of the Israelis couldn't care less. They don't see it, they don't want to see it, and they are being held by a media they don't want to show. They are stuck in October 7th, and they don't want to recognize what is going on October 8th. And the pictures from Gaza, if you want to see them, you can dig it, but most of the Israelis sitting in their coffee houses, drinking coffee, feeling very comfortable. And they don't know what's going on down their noses 200 meters in the West Bank, for example, which every day people are being killed there by the settlers and the army. They don't want to know. The media doesn't show them. And the brainwashing system goes on. There are two major things in the mind of every and each and every Israeli, which are basic. One is the victimhood mentality. We are born with 3,000 years on our shoulders, 3,000 years of slavery and the victimhood and the atrocities. It's not an invented victimhood, it's a real victimhood. And we carry it on our backs since we are born. And we are being taught to feel that no one else is allowed to be victim, only us. And we send our kids to Auschwitz when they are 16 years old, and they come back dragged with a national flag and the slogan "Never Again." And the next day, they are sitting in a checkpoint, and this 18 years old guy needs to make a decision whether this 70 years old guy coming towards him is a terrorist or a grandfather, which is inhuman. This is one basic thing. The feeling is that we are holding a sword in our hand, defending our very existence. And if we will let the sword down for 1 second, we are doomed and we'll be terrorists. And this is a basic, and the ability to take a stand and to say, that's it. Victimhood is stopping here with me. And I will not use my victimhood in order to victimize others. This is something which is almost impossible to do. The other major thing is Jewish nationality and Jewish superiority and the inability to recognize the rights of other people who are different from you only by religion and their right to enjoy every democratic and political and existential right that you have. This is a basic problem, and I don't see any solution to the conflict without giving up these two major issues.
Rami, you answer a question I was going to get to in a bit that many people in my community on Substack and so on have been asking. What are Israeli Jews and many Jews worldwide feeling and experiencing? What is at the heart of their very evident and understandable collective trauma and their need to feel secure and their fear following October 7, of course, that seems to also be stopping many from seeing what's happening in Gaza as history repeating itself, as something that should never again happen anywhere? It's quite startling to hear you explain it in this way.
Because I'm a victim who have decided not to use his victimhood in order to victimize other people. And I can tell you from personal experience, it's not easy.
Yeah. And what did you have to do to do that? Like, how did you make that choice?
I met Bassam.
Okay. Did you grow up, Rami, knowing Palestinians? Or what was your understanding? What was your impression of Palestinians growing up before this relationship with Bassam?
Well, I'm a victim of the Israeli upbringing system. I was brainwashed. These Arabs were hidden from me, deliberately and viciously, because, as I said, it was part of a brainwashing system of the Israeli education. And it took me, you know, I knew Palestinians as workers in the streets, as terrorists, but I never, ever had felt the need to create friendship or to, even to know each other. I remember very vividly that when there was an Arabic music in the radio, I was switched to another station. This is part of the brainwashing system. And the first crack in this wall was the day I was invited to watch a meeting of the parent circle. And the first time that I met Palestinians as human beings. And I was 47 years old at the time. And I'm completely ashamed to admit that it was the first time that I met Palestinians as human beings. And ever since then, I started a journey towards the other side, towards the nobility and the wisdom of the other side, the narrative of the other side, the food, the music, the culture, everything. And I'm still in the middle of it.
We might have to backtrack a bit to give people your story as to how you became, well, friends, brothers, and where that beautiful, loving relationship started. Rami, can you take us back to, I guess, September 1997, when you lost your daughter. Do you mind just sharing what happened on that day?
I was on my way to the airport to bring my wife's mother, who was coming back from the United States. And on the way, my phone rang, and my wife was on the line. She said that there was a bombing in Jerusalem, and someone saw Smadari, my daughter, walking down the... And then I put on the radio and I saw all the police cars rushing towards Jerusalem. And I had... You had the feeling that your blood runs cold. And then she disappeared and we were spending the whole day looking for her. She completely vanished. And we went from hospital to hospital and from police station to police station. Many long, frustrating hours until eventually, very later that night, we went to the morgue near Tel Aviv. And we saw the sight which you will never be able to forget for the rest of our lives. Every little hope that you had disappears. You see it before your naked eyes. And it's final. It's there is nothing you can do about it. Then we went back home. The house immediately was filled with thousands and thousands of people. The death of Smadar shook the nation upside down because she was the granddaughter, late General Matti Peled, who was one of the pioneers of peace between Israelis and Palestinians. And the murder of the granddaughter of this peace activist was quite a shock.
The way that it's described in the book, A Paragon, it captured me. I couldn't move on in the book. I had to sit with it for a day or two, just the way that it all unfolded. I know the year Smadar was killed, Bassam, your daughter Abir, was born. And then she was also killed 10 years later by an Israeli policeman outside her school. Completely unprovoked. And I know after many delays, her body was in the ambulance. There were border crossing issues. You got to hospital and Rami and his wife were there. How was it to have them both there? How was that?
To be honest, it was very expected. It was a very normal thing. And if it's happened to Rami, I will be the first one, of course, especially Rami and Uri. We become very close friends. And they know Abir personally. We know each other 2 years before this tragedy. And this is Rami, the human being, the noble human being. And he was the first one that I called because I feel that I need to call him simply. And they stay with me with other 30 Israeli families in the hospital for 3 days or 2 days until Abir passed away. Now there is something, when I look at Rami and see in his eyes kind of guilt, or kind of responsibility, you know, it's our guy, linked to us. This was very painful for me. And I don't know what to do to say to Rami, brother, it's not you. It's not your side. Like with other many other Israeli friends. So I find myself saying to them, we are family. We will remain to be a family. It's not your responsibility. You are exactly like me. We are against this kind of evil, like together. Of course, in those days, those moments, those hours, Rami and Nurit's support was very important for me and my family, of course.
I know that Rami said to you in the hospital, what are we going to do now? Which is a big question. What did the two of you decide to do?
You know, I was already in another place in that time. And already I released myself from the victimhood mentality. I get to know my enemy, to see my enemy, and to understand my enemy with all his brutality. It's exactly like me. So yeah, it was a very difficult moment. For them, it was like, Abir is the daughter of the founder of Combatants for Peace. What we are going to do next? Rami feel that he lost Smadar again. How I'm going to act? So, in fact, I said from the beginning, we need to double our efforts to achieve peace, especially now, because simply I have another 5 kids. I want to protect them. I don't want to lose them. And I believe that kids or children killed almost every day in Palestine and sometimes in Israel. And I said, you cannot say, why me? Because I am also part of this society. That means I don't wish anyone else to have the same feeling forever. So I said, I believe God is testing us. In other words, maybe he's testing me because I'm talking about peace, about justice, about forgiveness, which is a very personal thing. So now when it's happened to you, it's up to you to remain with your own values or to go back to be a victim. It means to go back to use violence, which is very easy, which is very human. But I said, I am not a killer. I don't want to be like the same one who harmed me. I consider him a victim himself. When I meet him in the court, I said to him, you are not a hero. You are not a warrior. You didn't kill the enemy or the terrorist. You just killed an innocent girl.
You're referring, of course, to seeing the Israeli soldier who killed your daughter, Abir, when you met him outside court when the case did in fact go to trial. But Bassam, I might ask the same question that I asked Rami. How was it for you to become friends with someone you'd been told was your enemy?
As I said, it's not a big honor for a Palestinian to have a friend in the Israeli side. What's the meaning of friend? They are occupying us. You know, this is the normal relationship. We are not equals. So what happened, always in my mind, I want to be a real partner for my enemy. Not to love him, not to like him even. They want peace, I want peace. They need to respect my right, my right to live in peace and dignity and social justice and freedom and democracy. I will respect theirs and we can enjoy hating each other forever. But since I met Rami, I discovered the nobility of my enemy. In fact, I fell in love with him, but sometimes to offend him, I said he fell in love with me. We share the same kind of values. I don't talk as a Palestinian. He don't talk as an Israeli. We care about our fellow human beings. This is the normal thing to do. We understand nationalism is kind of extremism. If you lose your empathy to the others, simply you lose your humanity. So when the people cannot see the kids in Gaza, the children in Gaza, they consider them human animals. This is the end of their own humanity, not the humanity of the kids who have been killed. So this is why we a little bit unique, let me say, because we see kids as kids. We see women as women, Israelis and Palestinians. Both of them suffer. Both of them have the right to exist and to live in a safer place.
Rami, there's a line that I found, I think, in an interview you did a little while ago. You say, when they see us together, this puts the first crack in the wall. A little light comes in. No one can listen to us and remain the same. Do you feel that that is still the impact that you're having? You have been continuing your work together, your peace work, as part of Parents Circle. Is that what is happening at the moment? Can you describe the reaction that you're being greeted with around the world?
Ever since October 7th, we are being interviewed 4 to 5 times a day to media all around the world. Our messages spread, and we are a very, very peculiar thing. You should hate each other. How come you love each other? They are looking for interest. And everyone looks at the whole situation. It's like a reality game on television. The world is sitting on the balcony watching those crazy people spilling the blood of each other. And it became like a football fans. You know, it's my team or your team. And this is completely, completely crazy because we show our wounds to one another and we are competing on the ugliness of the wounds instead of understanding that we are the majority. I mean, we are the people who wants peace. If you understand what I mean, I am saying that the line does not divide Israelis and Palestinians. The line divides people, Israelis and Palestinians, human beings, Christians, Muslims, whatever, who wants peace and are willing to pay the price of peace, and all the others. We are the majority, and we will win in the end. And this message creates such an interest, it draws such an attention, that the peak of it was yesterday when we met the Pope. And it works. It works because this is what people want. People want hope. People want understanding. People want love. People want what we are selling.
What did the Pope say? I'm very interested in what he said to you both.
It was amazing, in fact, and very exciting meeting for both of us. And for me, the moment when he asked us to pray for him, it's a proof that, yes, no one is God. We are all human beings. We are very simple human beings. And especially someone like this great man, he's very modest. He understands that we need each other. As we ask him to pray for freedom for the Palestinians and peace in the Middle East, to stop this genocide or this ceasefire now, he asked us to pray for him. So, in fact, I said to him, I wish you a long and healthy life to continue leading this world in this peaceful way. We give him the book, a Paragon, with a special note that wherever there is love, there is peace. And Rami wrote also in Hebrew and English. It was a very spiritual meeting, let me say, to spread the message of peace and reconciliation. It's very important, and especially we expect, as Rami said sometimes, more from such a leader, to be very sharp, and he's sharp when he asked for stopping this, what's going on in Gaza and in the West Bank.
Not only that, this was the meeting between us took place before the ceremony. And then in the ceremony, he sat on the stage and totally out of context. I mean, it was not in his prepared speech. He started talking about us and about our story. People went crazy. I mean, there were 10,000 people in the audience. When we were out, all of them were standing on their feet, picturing us with their phones, shouting at us, bless you, bless you, bless you. It was very embarrassing.
Yeah, well, embarrassing is one way of putting it, but absolutely beautiful as well. I think your story is one that's just cutting through, particularly at the moment, as many people outside of the Middle East who are not used to fathoming the complexity, the many layers of pain and victimhood and blaming the other side that has been going on for many years. We're needing people to show us that really there is no other way to do this other than to, as you say, Rami, we can't be opposing sides on this football field. We need to actually be coming together rather than fighting amongst each other. I feel I keep needing to come back to some of the background here for people who don't know your story. Bassam, you were 17 when you went to Israeli prison for 7 years. Can you tell people what landed you there?
In fact, I was 13 years old when I joined another four kids from my classmate to in order to raise the Palestinian flag on the trees around our school to annoy the Israeli soldiers, because they become very nervous and crazy when they see this flag, and I don't understand why. So we use this tool to make them crazy. That's it. This is our struggle. When someone occupied you, you hate him simply. It's exactly like that. And we hate those soldiers because they are very brutal and we don't understand why. We don't know their language. They don't look like us. And we don't understand they come to occupy our village or our neighborhood. At the age of 16, we find some old weapons in a cave with two grenades and other military materials that we don't know how to use it. But two of my friends throw the two grenades on the Israeli soldiers, patrols, in our village near Hebron. And in that time, no one killed, no one injured, because they don't know how to use it in a professional way. And 1 year later, at the age of 17, I have been arrested with them. So the first one get 21 years in jail, 19, 15, 14, and I had 7 years. In jail, you receive yourself as a hero, as a fighter, as a warrior. This is what I consider, in spite, I never harm anyone, not Israeli and not Palestinian, but because I was in jail for 7 years, this is my contribution to the Palestinian national struggle. I consider a hero because they put me in jail. I considered a terrorist for the Israelis and the Americans, maybe. Only because I was in jail. It doesn't matter if you are right or wrong, how old are you, what you really did, that's it. Israeli occupation judge you, so that's it. This is what happened. In fact, I learned in jail, if you know your enemy, you can defeat him or you can kill him. If you only hate him, you will kill yourself. This is what pushed me to start to study Hebrew, the language of the enemy, because I want to kill my enemy, not myself. Then shortly, I watch a movie about the Holocaust. And as I said, the Holocaust for me, it's not exist. I never hear about it. I know someone called Hitler killed 6 million Jewish people, but it's a big lie. In spite, it's a big lie. I want to enjoy seeing this movie, to see how they killed them, how they arrested them, how they occupied them, because I am in their jails. It's a very personal thing. But suddenly, I found myself crying after a few minutes. Because it's against the nature of the human being. It's against my nature. I don't expect to see such atrocities. I get angry for those people who have been killed in the movie. It means the Jewish. Because they didn't fight. I want them to fight and to kill those Nazis or officers. Which has pushed me after more than 25 years to make my master's degree about the Holocaust. Because I want to understand more about the other side. And I start to visit death camps in Germany, but again, it starts as a tool to know your enemy. Then you understand that if you know more, you act much better. If you don't know, simply you don't know, and you are a victim to what you know.
Yeah, I think a lot of people will be very surprised to hear that that was your reaction, because you're also a prison leader when you're in jail. It's certainly not the track that people would have expected you to go down. I'm wondering, Bassam, what did this teach you about the Israeli occupation of Palestine, about the walls and about the surveillance and about having to keep Palestinians in an open-air prison? And how has it helped you maybe understand what is happening right now in Gaza and the West Bank?
I would say two very short things. First, back maybe 17 years ago, an Israeli lady in a lecture asked me why we occupied you. So I said, no, you admit that we occupied you. Perfect. She said, okay, we occupied you. Why? So I want to talk about the historical reasons, the Zionist movement. And she said, no. In a very personal level. Why? I don't know what she wants exactly. And she said, because we fear from you. We scare from you. And number two, I believe the Israelis are victims exactly as the Palestinians to the Israeli occupation and to the American policy. Unfortunately, this is what I said to all the Americans, the politicians, even to the President Biden himself, that if there is no Israel, we must invent Israel to invest in $3 billion each year to protect our own interests. So please invest in our peace instead of to invest in our blood.
Did you say that you've met with Biden?
No, I sent him a message many times through the media as a bereaved father. He lost his son. He must understand exactly our feelings as fathers. He cannot say on one side that he's very human, he's very democratic, and the other side supporting Israel unconditionally. He's responsible for this mass killing in Gaza, unfortunately. If he say yes or no, they are very active part in the war in Gaza, not war, a massacre.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Whenever I come across people who have been able to have a relationship like you and Rami have, to be able to see the perspective of the other side and to see that there's not, in fact, another side, it requires people meeting. It requires people being in the same room as each other. And when you live in a part of the world that has a wall separating the two sides, when you have a part of the world where Israelis don't meet Palestinians and Palestinians don't meet Israelis, I'm wondering, you know, do you feel that this is one of the biggest problems and that it's kind of intrinsic in what the occupation is about, keeping people separate?
It's exactly the point, exactly. We are in a total cut-off, total separated, in spite we consider like we live together. And this is the point. It's forbidden for the Israelis to come to the Palestinian side. They will be in jail. They will have tickets because it's under their responsibility. We have these red lines in the front of the Palestinian cities. The goal is to scare the Palestinians to come to see what is the occupation look like. Because I don't believe that the Israelis, or the majority of the Israelis, can accept those atrocities. What's going on in the West Bank under any circumstances. Now, the vast majority, they don't want to know because it will challenge their own history, their own humanity, which is very difficult, of course. So this is one of the points that the world built these separation walls to prevent people to see each other and to be together as human beings. Yes, I believe this is one of the main obstacles.
Rami, perhaps I can ask you now, what needs to shift for there to be change, for there to be a resolution here? How do we bring down these walls?
I think it connects to what I told you before, the victimhood mentality and the Jewish superiority. And the feeling of a victim is very comfortable because then you don't have to do anything. You are fighting for your life and you blame everyone for anti-Semitism when they criticize you. But if you are being able to rise above the current events and understand that you are being fooled, that Hamas is an Israeli invention that was invented in 87 by the Israeli security forces as a weight against the PLO, that Hamas was giving billions and billions of dollars by Mr. Netanyahu and his government, and they called Hamas an asset. Understand that you cannot make the Palestinians disappear. You cannot solve the problem by creating negotiations with the Saudi Arabia or the Emirates or and ignore the existence of the Palestinians. October 7th show us you can build fences, you can go into electronics, you can have the strongest army in the world. You are a nuclear power, and yet in 2 hours on October 7th morning, it all collapsed because we don't have peace with the Palestinians. I believe that once the Israelis will understand that violence will not lead to anywhere, that they're using more force and more force will only create more problems and more problems. I always tell them that the Hamas terrorists that did the October 7th were 12 and 10 years old kids in 2014 when the IDF hit Gaza. When will be the next October 7th? Will these 30,000 killed, their relatives, will they forget? Will they forgive? We need to stop it. We need to stop this endless cycle of violence. Because if you want to make revenge, you have to dig two graves. One for your enemy, but one for yourself. I believe deeply the majority of the Israeli people are good people, sane people, and they understand that the price is too high. It's not worth it. The most dangerous place today for Jews around the world is Israel. And people are not stupid. People see it. I hope and I think that one day they will wake up. One way they will decide that the price is too high. And mothers will start standing on their front legs and say, I will not send my son to sacrifice his life for the kingdom of the whole of Israel. And then there is the role of the free and civilized world. That during the Holocaust, stood aside and did nothing. That during the genocide in Syria, stood aside and did nothing. That always Ukraine almost doing nothing. And the free and civilized world moral obligation is to step in and put pressure.
How do you feel about that, Bassam? Do you feel there's hope? Do you feel there will be a peace agreement? Do you feel we've hit rock bottom and we may, things may go up from here?
In general, I don't talk about hope. I talk about faith. Believe me, that we are not going to continue killing each other forever. It's not written anywhere. And always I remember the conflicts around the world, from the Romans to now. I always said that the Palestinians didn't kill 6 million Israelis. The Israelis didn't kill 6 million Palestinians yet. And there is a German ambassador in Tel Aviv, and there is an Israeli ambassador in Berlin. After 4 years of the Holocaust, after 4 years of 6 million victims, the best relationship between Israel and Germany. How come? People are very strong when they find the good leader to release them from the very painful past and to look forward. The Holocaust is over. We cannot make anything about it. The Nakba, it was, and yes, continue up to date, but it means we can talk about them another 75 years. We just create a victimhood industry, fear industry. And when we decide to release ourselves, we can see the relationship between Israel and Germany. Of course, the examples of Germany and France and the UK and South Africa, Northern Ireland, 800 years. Then they signed the same agreement. So one day, yes, you will have peace, absolutely, which is very close, by the way, because the world cannot keep silence while they are seeing this massacre taking place on the TVs. So it was very great to see those all those empathy and solidarity with the Palestinians. It means because the Palestinians deserve justice. When we talk about justice for the Palestinians, it's automatically security for the Israelis, because it will be no security for the Israelis without justice and freedom for the Palestinians. And I said always that from the river to the sea, everyone should be free.
Yes, that's a good use of the phrase. But some, there's a lot of listeners in Australia, in America, in the UK, around the world, who I know are wondering what they can do to help. They're watching this injustice. They're feeling helpless. What do you advise people to do?
To never keep silence. This is what Martin Luther King says. In the end, we will remember not the words of our enemies, but the silence of our friends. So believe me, when it's happened to you, and maybe it will happen to you, no one is safe in those days, you will find me raising my voice for you. Otherwise, no one will remain raising his voice for you. You need to be like, to support your own values, freedom, democracy, justice, human rights for everyone. The occupation must end, and the war criminals must go to justice. Otherwise, no one will respect justice and international justice for call for justice or for war criminal. Big state will eat the small state, and we will go back to be in a forest in the dark ages. If you don't protect democracy, democracy will never protect you. And we are a very simple people. We want to live in a very simple place. I want to send my kids to their school and get them back safe. I don't want to kill anyone. I don't want to throw anyone to the sea. I just want to exist exactly like the Israelis. And we deserve to live in peace and security. And we prove that we can. And this is an example, me and Rami and thousands of Israelis and Palestinians. So this is our message. Always support us. Always raise up your voice for us.
Rami, would you add anything to that?
I would like to emphasize one point which is dominant in the discussion, and I think it's important to understand it, which is the fact that I am a Jew. I'm a proud Jew, with the utmost respect to my people and to my history and to my tradition and to my religion. And I will tell you that ruling and oppressing and humiliating and occupying millions and millions of people for so many years without any democratic right is not Judaism. There is nothing Jewish about it. Being against it is not anti-Semitism. The use of the word anti-Semitism became a weapon in the struggle. Between the two narratives. It's completely wrong. The worst place for Jews around the world today is Israel. And the price that we are paying has nothing to do with Judaism. It's to do with occupation. It has to do with oppression. It has to do with many atrocities, misjustice. Anti-Semitism exists. It backrooted many, many years ago. The price of anti-Semitism was millions and millions of Jews that went to the ovens in Europe. But the main creator of anti-Semitism today is Israel and its actions, and it can be dealt with. It can be changed. It's not something that we inherit with our mother.
Yeah. Both of you, I'm so grateful for your time. I'm so grateful for your care and for your work, for your story, for your friendship, and for everything that you've taught me. Your story cracked open both my heart and my mind. Both have been fundamentally changed by your story. So thank you so much, and Godspeed and much courage to you.
Thank you, Sarah. I really appreciate it for you taking the time to listen to my very sad story, but I think it's important, and I really thank you.
Again, everyone, apologies for the quality of this recording. It was all very touch and go, but it was a recording I just had to get while I could. I will just say I could definitely have gone harder with the questions. I could have drilled down into whether what we're seeing here is a genocide or not, whether a two-state or a one-state solution is the way forward. And I suppose I could have gone down the route of comparing deaths and timelines and all the rest. But if there is one thing that I've learned from reading Bassam and Rami's story in the book A Paragon and from talking to them, all those things are distractions and are somewhat irrelevant. There has been pain, too much pain, in all directions for millennia in this region. And what's key right now, what will stop more children and innocent people being murdered, is ending the occupation. The occupation imprisons Israelis and Palestinians and all of us. There are so many points I got from the conversation, and I'll run through a few now. The main theme is victimhood. Rami is searingly honest about how he feels that Israelis have been brainwashed, his words, into remaining in a victimhood mindset that does not allow for anyone else to be a victim. Bassam is equally scathing of the victim mode. He says it only sends you back into more violence. He refers to what's going on as a victimhood industry. For anyone interested in learning a bit more about this idea of victimhood being the central issue at a deep psychological level, the Jewish writer and philosopher Naomi Klein has been commenting and writing on it for quite some time. And I'll put a link to some of the resources in the show notes. They're very, very interesting. The idea of there not being another side, another, an enemy, is also key. There are infinite sides, or you might want to say just the one side, the side of humanity. And the enemy in this scenario is the occupation. It's the forces that critically stop humans from meeting, from seeing each other's humanity up close. It's the building of walls. It's the indoctrination that's the enemy. It's the saddest, cruelest thing, I think, that these two peoples are denied the ability to see each other's humanity. Both the Israeli government and Hamas have worked to ensure their people don't see the other side, at least not as humans. It's their most powerful weapon in this war. I liked Bassam's point as well, that Palestinians didn't kill 6 million Jews. And there's an Israeli embassy in Germany right now and a German embassy in Israel. When he said this, it suddenly made me aware this conflict is not about what we're being told it's about. Rami says Israel is fueling the anti-Semitism more than anyone else in the world at the moment. I've heard a number of Jewish commentators say the same, and it's really jolting to hear it, I've got to say. Bassam exposes the extent of President Biden's hypocrisy. Of course, he lost a son himself. How can he not come back to this in his decision-making? Mostly, though, what I took from our conversation is the reminder of the importance of coming back to our humanity. Bassam said if we lose empathy, we lose our humanity. Both Bassam and Rami reference the nobility of the other. They talk of falling in love with each other. And I've watched videos of the two of them. They delight in each other. They crack jokes and finish each other's sentences. It's this that we need to seek out in each other, in ourselves, in our stories. We need to fight for our humanity. We need to look out for moments or instances of our own behaviour, in our own resistance to this war, where we veer from our humanity and into this two-sidism and blaming and othering. And let's keep remembering it's when we deny each other and ourselves the ability to see another's humanity, to meet, that is the war, that is the enemy. Finally, I do love that the Pope, a Catholic, asked them, a Muslim and a Jew, to pray for him. After I finished our very awkward and clunky conversation, once again I apologise, around about midnight, after my long, long flight to Paris, my head throbbing with this flu and flu medication, I burst into tears, and it was this image of 10,000 people at the Vatican cheering Rami and Bassam, two noble men who've been pitted against each other all their lives, that took me down. And maybe just to finish, I'll share a line from a poem called Unfortunately, It Was Paradise by Palestine's national poet Muhammad Darwish. I think it's fitting. "Be my lover between two wars waged in the mirror," she said. "I don't want to return now to the fortress of my father's house. Take me to your vineyard. Let me meet your mother, perfume me with basil water. Arrange me on silver dishes, comb me, imprison me in your name. Let love kill me." All right, stay wild, all of you, and I'll see you for next week's episode where I tell the rest of this story.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.